Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We all know how hot Sacramento will get this summer. One relief are public pools, but access can vary depending on where you live. A recent example is Sacramento's Southside Park, which closed last summer and was the only pool in the city's central area. That closure was due to some swimmers reporting rashes, but it also puts a spotlight on the reality that public pools are more than a place just to cool off, but spaces for socializing, exercise, as well as health and wellness. They're also expensive to build, including to maintain and staff. And where the city prioritized public pools highlights a lack of equity with a deep history to unpack. That's why CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb is here. Kristen joins us with the history about public pools that may surprise some of our listeners. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Vicky.
So when did your interest about Sacramento city pools begin?
In late April, I saw that the Southside Park Neighborhood Association was sounding the alarm, saying the only pool in the central city was closed indefinitely. It made me interested in looking into whether there were larger equity issues in public swimming pool access beyond this one case, especially since we had such devastating heat waves last summer with all those flex alerts.
Yeah, and last summer that public pool closed, as you mentioned, and people were reporting that some of the swimmers were getting rashes. What were the rashes from?
The city found that the pool's fiberglass lining gave people skin irritation, so they closed it for safety reasons. Councilmember Katie Valenzuela represents the area. She said at first the Parks Department thought they could fix it in the off-season, but then they found out the pool needs to be completely resurfaced or replastered. Because of the age of the pool and increased construction costs, they didn't have funding on hand for such a major repair.
And although the name is Southside Park, the pool is actually in the city center, correct?
Correct, yeah. It's near the intersection of 6th and U Street. It's in Southside Park, which is a neighborhood closer to downtown than South Sacramento. The park's just north of Highway 50 and west of I-5.
Yeah, it's where the farmers markets used to be on Sundays. So the city also says that, you know, it's going to cost a lot of money, right? It's going to cost over $1 million to resurface Southside Park, the pool specifically. So what do we know about when that might actually happen?
3 weeks ago, Valenzuela told me the city was on track to be able to reopen the pool in summer 2024. At the time, she couldn't say where they would be getting the funding from.
But there's going to be a press conference today. So are they going to be announcing some funding when talking about this public pool?
Yes. Just 15 or so minutes ago, Kevin McCarthy's office sent out an email that it was able to get $500,000 to help with renovations to reopen it. And I'll note that this is the first time publicly that the state assembly member has gotten involved in this. His district includes Southside Park. But at this point, we don't know about other funding.
So it's likely it's not going to be done this summer.
That's right, because they'll still have to put the project out to bid and hire a contractor to resurface it. And all city pools close by early September.
Got it. There is the Southside Park Neighborhood Association. That's what really piqued your interest into this story. When you talk to the association, you know, what's their opinion about how the city is prioritizing the funding to fix community resources like pools?
She was disappointed to see the proposal for the upcoming budget include setting aside $90,000 to demolish an old shed at the park. Cox says it didn't make sense for the city to prioritize park development fees for the shed when the money could go toward a swimming pool people actually use. Here's what she thinks of the bigger picture.
With rising costs and everything, and, you know, money's always going to be a problem, but like there's not much of a plan in place for preventing this from continuing to happen. And I just hope that we don't continue just like waiting for a pool to need to be closed for a year or two to get it resurfaced, to open it again. And I think that, you know, having the budget for regular maintenance would be really great.
Yeah, and that's Sarah Cox, who's the president of the Southside Park Neighborhood Association. When it comes to Southside Park and the pool, that really isn't the only public space that needs a lot of money to fix up and to repair. What have you learned about the deferred maintenance that's happening in the city?
So the city had about more than $130 million in deferred parks maintenance as of last month. This includes delayed projects to resolve safety issues and code violations at parks, pools, and community buildings. It has all this deferred maintenance because current park development fees aren't enough to cover costs. To put things into perspective, the city has a proposed budget of $1.5 billion for the upcoming fiscal year.
So that means the city has to make tough decisions when it comes to prioritizing some projects over others. So what projects are going to be fixed or getting ready to open or reopen?
Yeah, in terms of pools, the city was resurfacing McClatchy Pool in Oak Park last month. That's scheduled to open on June 17th. The ribbon cutting for Higginwood Park's all-weather sport field replacement also happened about a month ago. The city is also aiming to open the Mama Mark splash pad next summer. It used to be a wading pool.
What are some of the neighborhoods that have been impacted by the closure of Southside Park Pool? Because there are a lot of communities that surround that park.
First, there's Southside Park itself, east of I-5, where Cox says most people don't have backyard pools, let alone big yards to put a sprinkler on. Two public housing communities are also within about a mile of the pool, Alder Grove and Marina Vista, which used to be called CV Circle. Some of those units don't have air conditioning.
Yeah, so if you don't have air conditioning, you don't have a yard to put a sprinkler on, you don't get that relief. And then, as you mentioned last summer, we had these flex alerts and just really grueling triple-digit temperatures. A lot of people might not realize these equity issues when it comes to public spaces like pools and parks, especially when one like Southside Park, which we're focusing on, the pool has closed. When it comes to the demographics, the people who live in the area, why is this pool so important for them?
About 39% of residents living where the pool is located live at or below the poverty level, according to census data. And when you move down to the area just south, where the public housing communities are, that statistic rises to 52%. So many people in these communities don't have a lot of disposable income, or they might lack access to reliable transportation. Having a neighborhood public pool within walking distance is a huge deal. Admission is usually $2 or $4, and it isn't just a place to cool down. It's also a place to socialize and exercise.
Yeah, and that's affordable when it's within walking distance, right? Because you mentioned not everyone has access to reliable transportation. You did also talk to some people who are questioning why money for parks and pools and community centers, that it's really not prioritized in their minds. And you had a conversation with Darius Hinson, and he's the principal at Grant Union High School.
Hinson saw similarities between the situations in Southside Park and Del Paso Heights. He says both neighborhoods lack access to a nearby city pool and haven't received the same historic investment as higher income communities. Some older homes in Del Paso Heights also don't have air conditioning. But unlike Southside Park, Del Paso Heights has a school pool filling the gap right now. The Twin Rivers School District opens the Grant High School pool to the summer, to the public every summer. This year, admission will be free. Still, Hinson says the community would benefit from a city facility similar to the North Natomas Aquatics Complex.
And I don't believe that enough pressure is put on having equitable facilities like other communities that might be a little bit more affluent. And because that same kind of pressure, that political pressure is not put, we tend to fall short when it comes to things like having a viable aquatic facility for a community of this nature.
How does he envision, what would he like to see when it comes to a viable aquatic facility for the Del Paso Heights community?
He would like to see a family-friendly public pool that's accessible to everyone. The current Grant High pool, which opened in 2017, is designed for water polo and competitive swimming. So most of it is 7 feet deep, unlike the high school pool that he grew up going to. He said Mama Mark's Park would be a great place to build an aquatics facility. But like we talked about earlier, the city is planning to replace a wading pool there with a splash pad.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Kristen Lamb, CAP Radio's Sacramento government reporter, about the importance of community or public pools and some of the issues of equity they raise based on where they're built and the funding and resources given to them. So, Kristen, you also learned about the disparity of where pools are built, why they are prioritized in certain areas, some neighborhoods and not others. Can you explain how redlining comes into play and how particularly Black people were historically treated in public pools?
I talked with Helene Margolis about that. She's an associate adjunct professor in the UC Davis Department of Internal Medicine, who also works in the university's Climate Adaptation Research Center. Here she is explaining nationwide research.
Historically, because of the structural racism, pools were not built in redlined areas or in poor areas, and those pools that were built for many generations, African American, Black people, people of color, were excluded. They could not use those pools. And it's a problem that still exists because of this sort of legacy. So you have just geographically, the pools aren't available.
Yeah, and that trickles down to the ability to swim. Where do people of color fall when it comes to that? And how does income factor into this as well?
There's a 2017 study that by the USA Swimming Foundation that looked at Houston, Jacksonville, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and Memphis. Researchers found 64% of Black and 45% of Latino children reported little to no swimming ability. And white children, 40% reported the same issue. So basically, because generations of Black people were barred from public swimming pools, Black children today are less likely to be able to swim. The study also found 79% of children in households with annual incomes less than $50,000 have low swimming ability.
You mentioned, or I believe when we were talking about Del Paso Heights, there was mention of the Natomas Aquatics Complex, and that's a relatively new complex in Natomas. The city of Sacramento, they opened it up. It's a $40 million aquatic center. Can you talk to us about the demographics there and how it compares to the other areas we were talking about?
Yeah, the city opened it last year in April. U.S. Census data shows in the area near the complex, only 15% of residents live at or below the poverty line. That's a much lower rate than near the Southside Park pool. It doesn't have just a 25-yard recreational pool, but a competition pool, splash pool, and water slides, too. Before it opened, a Natomas mother told me the closest public pool was a 20-minute drive away at McKinley Park. The complex is now just a 5 to 7 minute trip from
their
home.
That's a big difference. You also spoke to Angela Short, who was enjoying her time at the Natomas Aquatics Complex. What was her experience like?
Short lives in Carmichael, but she came to the complex with friends. She says air conditioning is expensive at her apartment and management hasn't fixed the pool there. She grew up in South Sacramento as a teenager, used to walk to a swimming pool. Here she is explaining why she enjoys public pools.
As long as I can get out of the heat, get some exercise, I'm happy. I don't swim like I used to because I was injured in a car accident. So my right hip is all mangled, and what swimming does is that I'm not putting pressure on this hip, and I can have fun.
Yeah, I mean, it is a low-impact exercise, and most importantly, it's not just relief from the heat, it's also a lot of fun for all ages. When people are going to be heading to a pool this summer, what kind of precautions should they keep in mind when they're swimming during these triple-digit temperatures?
Margolis, the UC Davis professor, says people need to keep in mind that swimming outdoors during extreme temperatures can contribute to heat-related illness, particularly if there isn't any shade and if pool water gets too warm. Swimmers need to stay hydrated and keep in mind sunburns can reduce ability to both sweat and cool down. So make sure to use sunscreen.
And again, we don't know what's going to come of today's press conference. You got a little bit of details, you know, about a half hour ago from Assemblymember Kevin McCarty's office about funding for Southside Park's pool. But what can you tell us about the other city pools that are going to be open this summer?
All of the other 11 neighborhood pools will be open by June 17th. That's next Saturday. Doyle Pool in Northgate and Johnston Pool in North Sacramento open tomorrow and this Saturday.
Is there an easy place to check hours and availability?
You can find schedules in the park section of the city website. It's also linked in the full web story about this issue at capradio.org.
Kristen, as always, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Kristen Lamb is Cap Radio Sacramento government reporter. Up next, humans have a long, complicated history with fire. We'll meet an author helping children reimagine fire beyond its devastation, but also as a key part of life on our planet. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Since the dawn of our existence, humans have had a deep yet complicated relationship with one of Earth's essential yet volatile elements. Fire. Fire has played a critical role in our evolution as a species, and indigenous communities have embraced it for both practical and cultural purposes. But in the last century or so, our relationship with fire has fallen out of balance and became viewed overwhelmingly as a destructive force. Today, fires in California are largely associated with increasingly lethal and destructive wildfires. Those wildfires have not only destroyed homes and claimed lives, but have left traumatic experiences in their aftermath. A new children's book is hoping to help kids and their families reimagine fire as a key part of life on our planet. The book is titled Fire Shapes the World. I spoke with the book's author, Joanna Cook, who hopes the book can help humans reestablish a balanced relationship with fire. Well, Joanna, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm really happy to be here.
You know, often when we write, we're shaped by lived experiences. When did your understanding and your relationship with fire begin?
I would say that my relationship with fire began, or the first time I ever really considered it as an entity or as a thing to be thinking about, was when I worked in Yosemite as a field science educator and naturalist. And that was the first time that I both interacted with it in the landscape. I saw indigenous burns. I saw preventative burns happening through the National Park Service. And I was also in a position where, as an educator, I was trying to translate what was happening or what we could see on a fire burn landscape to young people when they came to the park. So that's when I first really thought about it. And then I had to figure out what I was going to say about it.
You spent nearly a decade teaching field science at Yosemite. How did you make the pivot, I guess, or how did this influence leading to pursuing another passion of yours, creative writing?
I think probably, even when I was in Yosemite, I did a lot of nature journaling and trying to process my experience of that place through writing. And that's always been a part of my journey. But after I moved to, I live in Jackson, Wyoming now. And after I moved here, I just was reinventing myself. I was having a child. I knew I wasn't doing field education anymore or working for the Park Service anymore. And I started writing stories for friends. And at that point I thought, well, this is a really interesting way to, you know, education and the work I was doing in Yosemite is a form of storytelling. And so now I'm just doing a different manifestation of that. And that it was fun to play around with, and I thought I would want to do it more seriously. So I started pursuing workshops and conferences and seeing what that felt like.
What's special writing for children and youth?
My relationship with nature is so based in wonder and curiosity, and young minds, that's exactly how we would describe a young mind. full of wonder, full of questions, and full of amazement. And that's what I, as an educator, that's what I tried to communicate with kids when they came to Yosemite National Park. How do you translate nature into something that's meaningful to us? How do you translate this beauty? How do you ask questions to understand it more or to see yourself as connected with that more? And so for me, it's that sense of wonder and curiosity. I really love trying to puzzle around. How do you relate? How do you make this big topic accessible to these young minds?
I think when it comes to fire or wildfire, there's so much that adults can learn, right? There's so much that, and even when it comes to this book, I mean, it's targeted for youth and children, but I learned something from Fire Shapes the World. Mm-hmm. And this is your third book. What motivated you to explore our relationship with fire and how it can improve?
So this book was my third that I published in conjunction with or through the Yosemite Conservancy. The Sequoia Lives On being the first, also a nonfiction picture book with a very similar lyrical style. And when we were working on that book, there's a spread where it discusses the way that that low burning forest fires are an important part of the ecology and survival of giant sequoia trees. And we were all really inspired by that concept and that idea and thought, well, that would be an interesting book to do, to work on another time. NYC Yosemite Conservancy had given me kind of like, well, these are the sort of things we're interested in exploring for young readers. And I picked out fire, and it took a number of years before I was able to even put something on the page. I spent a lot of time mulling the idea and thinking about the angle that I would want to take and what I would really try to say. But that's where it came from.
I learned that fire has a birthday.
Yes, yes. I think that particular fact was one thing that really hooked Yosemite Conservancy when I was pitching the actual manuscript to them. And so if you look back in time, that we know from the fossil record that about 420 million years ago is the first fossil fire evidence that scientists have discovered. Who knows what future discoveries will share with us. But when we think back to Earth hundreds of millions of years ago, there weren't plants on land. So there was nothing for a fire to burn anyway. And fire is dependent upon oxygen. And so if there were no plants that were emitting oxygen into the air, there was none of that sort of food, as we might say, for a fire to even start. There were no plants and there was no oxygen. So it needs this whole package. And when those conditions shifted on Earth hundreds of millions of years ago, then it was possible for fires to burn.
More than 400 million years ago is kind of a relative blip, you know, given that Earth is 4.5 billion years old, right? So it took a while to get here. How has our understanding and our relationship with fire evolved as we evolved as a species?
Well, when you think about paleoarchaeology and looking back at human history and hominid history, I suppose, fire has always been a part of the landscape that we've evolved with and in various forms. And so the idea that we evolved with fire on the landscape, whether or not we were directly manipulating it, comes later, but it's always been a part of the world that we evolved in. Like in the book, there's a spread of a group of paleo peoples surrounded the fire. And this light draws people in. It's enigmatic. It was a way in which communities came together. And also we understand the way that food, that we changed the way that the type of food that we were eating through fire. And so these like drawing together, this access to different food, these were the first initial kind of shifts that were changing the way fire changed us as individuals or as a species. And then we start to manipulate fire by carrying it into environments where maybe it wasn't that, so that because we've now developed communities and systems around it. And so it's been this kind of ebb and flow back and forth. And so when we think about the way in which traditional or indigenous knowledge is informing how we understand fire today, that's the sort of modern manifestation of this really, really long relationship with fire. Around a couple of hundred years ago, a Western mindset decided that fire wasn't appropriate for the landscape, that it was destructive. And so that marked a really big shift in this more dynamic, symbiotic relationship, maybe. And that resulted in the fires that we're seeing today, by and large, in which if you think that fire is bad for the landscape and you put out fires, then it results in more fuel on the ground for a fire to burn. So we get these bigger mega fires. And now that those mega fires have been in shape the way, we'll say, lay people are interacting with the idea of fire or the reality of fire in their communities. And hopefully now what's happening in the way that we are continuing to grow and evolve with fire is that we're inviting, and there's a big, I would say, movement in the news and in fire communities to really not only include, but to really highlight this Indigenous knowledge so that we can find some balance as we move forward.
We've had those conversations on Insight as well. I mean, it's a neglected piece in modern wildfire strategies over the last century or two, using, you know, good fire and having a healthy relationship with fire and wildfire and getting, you know, arguably too good at fire suppression. And now we have mega wildfires that are incredibly destructive and deadly. And that really encapsulates really the core of this, which is our relationship with fire. Fire can be destructive, it can be deadly, but it also has been really an asset to our evolution as a human species. Mm-hmm. And you tie that with these beautiful illustrations, including the cover, right? It's mm-hmm. it's a complicated relationship with fire, and humans are at the center of it. How did you work with illustrators to put these ideas and this history and this science and really bring it to life?
One of the benefits of working with a smaller publisher such as Yosemite Conservancy is that the author is very, or has the opportunity to be very involved in the entire creation of the book. Normally, as an author, I would be responsible for the text and text edits, working with an editor. But in this case, YC definitely invited me to be engaged. We found an illustrator. The first illustrator we worked with was Cornelia Lee. She read the text and she did extensive research. You know, the book covers 420 million years. That's huge in terms of
in a very digestible way, too, you know, for children to understand.
Right. Well, I think that was a, you know, having written the text, I knew that it was going to span this time. But then there's this leap of faith that you make when you collaborate with an illustrator of what's their vision going to be? And is their vision of the text going to jive with what I've envisioned for the text, and how do we modify that? How do we grow then together as we collaborate? So she did an incredible amount of research, and there was a lot of back and forth with facilitated through the editor that I worked with at Yosemite Conservancy toward figuring out what exactly we wanted to include. And did she have the right sources to find out about which plants would be on Earth at this particular time period? So it's really a very interesting and somewhat unusual collaboration. I'd not done that before. I think it's not as uncommon as we might think in the publishing world to have people step in and out of projects. But there was definitely a lot of back and forth into what we thought the illustrations would, which illustrations would best illuminate the points we were trying to make.
A piece of this in recent years, there are harmful consequences to wildfires across the Western United States and also in other countries as well. And a piece of that is trauma. So when we talk about wildfires now or fire, you know, it's a difficult topic. And last September, we spoke with a reporter from Kaiser Health News, and they really dove deep into how trauma and chronic health issues impacts tens of thousands of children in California. Given that this is a book for a younger audience, how did this shape your approach to writing and educating about fire and wildfires, given that it's a difficult topic?
When you write about any time an author or any storyteller is going to decide on a topic, they really need to name who their audience is going to be. And my editor, Nicole Geiger, and I had a conversation specifically at the very beginning during this sort of long marinating period when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to say. What we talked a lot about who the audience was really going to be. And we felt very clearly from the beginning that this was for a much broader audience rather than for specifically people who had experienced trauma due to wildfire in their lives. And the reason for that was that we really felt that that would be a completely different book. That would be a book that honored the trauma of their experience and the feelings and the grieving that would go with that. And so for this book, we wanted to zone out a little bit to think about a complex topic and see if we could find a way to provide, I'm a yes and kind of person. We wanted this to be a yes and. Yes, there's this destructive force that we see in our lives and in our landscape, and we hear it about in the news. And let's dig a little bit deeper. Let's look a little bit more closely to see what else might be there. And for young people, the world is pretty concrete, and we train them to do that from the beginning. Small, you know, picture books for young minds are about, you know, up and down and good and bad and dog and cat, or as opposites. We have these opposites. And that's really important when concrete minds are developing. And when you want to get into a space of talking about nuance, we have to create that opportunity for young people. It's not going to happen naturally necessarily to them. And as you go through life and you get older and older, you get more and more nuanced because you experience the grayness of life. And so for this, I think for me, zooming out to think about this real big picture, I had originally started writing the story with a single character in mind. And we were going to follow this character on the journey of losing a home and the emotions that went with that. And I realized that wasn't quite what I wanted to say or what was interesting for me. It was, it's an important story to tell. And it's all of those experiences are absolutely valid, but it wasn't, I wanted to zone back to that wonder and curiosity that really framed my experience as a young person and then as an early educator for people in establishing a connection to nature. So I think about like that, using a lyrical style of writing the picture book was one key for making that possible versus an expository style of writing, which would be more journalistic, for example, where you would be getting facts and information. I wanted to go to an emotional place, and having a more poetic, free-form narrative was what was going to help me get there.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with author Joanna Cook about her children's book, Fire Shapes the World, and how humans can reestablish a better relationship with fire. Okay, since you are a yes and kind of person, and there is obviously optimism attached to this book, what gives you optimism that humans, that society, and fire can find balance and harmony?
When I think about optimism for the future, I think about some of these leaders in the environmental movement or in the natural history movement. I think about David Attenborough and I think about Jane Goodall. These are two people who shaped my understanding and relationship with nature. And those are two incredibly hopeful individuals. They're like souls are exuding that. And knowing that with what they have seen and what they've been exposed to and the depth of understanding that they have about the challenges that we have ahead of us, and yet they are still hopeful, like that's an inspiration to step into it, step into that space of being hopeful. And I also feel like the idea that there are always new ideas and new minds and new players in this conversation about what we're going to go as humanity and where we're going to go with how we're engaging with nature and with Earth, that's inspiring to me, that we will always have an opportunity for people to push the conversation further, to look at it, to shine a light on it from a different perspective, that continual like renewal around it is what keeps that hope alive for me.
Is there anything that kind of keeps you up at night when it comes to concerns or worries in terms of the challenges of reimagining our relationship with fire?
Oh, sure. I have a 14-year-old son. And so I think about the world which we have created for him. We were recently watching the biography of David Attenborough that was available, and he couldn't watch it anymore. He wanted to stop because David Attenborough got real. The world is real. And it was too much emotion because it was too big. And so I feel like that is a terrifying idea. What is the world that we've created for children? And knowing that I have options. Every time you get to your crossroad, you have an option. I can either not do something or I can find a way that I want to engage that feels authentic to me. So engaging with the storytelling, engaging with young minds when they're developing their concepts and opinions and ideas, or even just gathering information so that when they develop an opinion later on, they have perspectives that will help them see things and more completely. They'll see the yes and the and. that's my choice. I have to choose that. I have to choose yes and.
Do you have an age range in mind for the reader?
We wrote this for 5 to 8-year-olds, and you'll see in the back that there's a lot of nonfiction these days has a back matter or an author's note that goes a little bit deeper. So by and large, the text is for 5 to 8-year-olds. And then this back matter goes deeper into the concepts. It's written for an adult reader who can then help translate some of these bigger concepts to their own, whoever they're reading to.
I appreciated that author's note. I learned a great deal. So I think it's certainly an important tool. You also have a teaching guide for those who are interested in utilizing this book in the classroom. How would you like it to be integrated in an educational setting?
Well, the teaching guide is based on the Common Core curriculum and the Next Generation Science Standards. So there, you will see a lot from both the literacy standpoint and from the ecology standpoint, activities and exercises that will meet the needs of your classroom. But I feel like for me that I've taught in elementary schools, my husband is a second grade teacher. So this idea of how to integrate it in the classroom is always on my mind because I want it to be usable. I feel like anytime we engage students with reading something and we're thinking about, you could analyze it from the perspective of how we talk about nonfiction text. What is nonfiction text and what are all the different ways that it can exist in a classroom? How does nonfiction inform us and inspire emotional response at us too in a way that we might normally expect from fiction? So what do we do with that? A lot of great discussions can happen from this. You might encourage them to think about, like for second grade standards, for example, you talk about fast and slow changes on the earth, and you can use this as a starting point for conversations because fire is going to bring a fast change through a megafire or a slow change through either a burn or if you're talking about geologic time. And so using text like this as a jumping off point for some of the bigger conversations you're having as a class, or if you're thinking about just perspectives, you're thinking about the world, there's a lot that you could do with it.
What is the lasting impression you hope this book has on families and children?
I hope that they look at the world and specifically fire with wonder and curiosity.
And this book, I got to mention this, it will also help support Yosemite National Park, right? Since it's a partnership mm-hmm. with the Conservancy?
Yes. All the proceeds will end up supporting the projects that Yosemite Conservancy does to support a stewardship and a connection in the park.
Wonderful. Joanna, it was great speaking with you. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
And that is Joanna Cook, author of the children's book, Fire Shapes the World, to help kids and their families reimagine fire as a part of life instead of just a destructive force. The book comes out next week and is available for pre-order. All proceeds go to the Yosemite Conservancy. Still ahead, we have another edition of Concert Connect, hooking you up with live music in Northern California. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's time for Concert Connect, where we hook you up with fast approaching live music before it passes you by. CAP Radio's Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia return with their top picks to kick off summer. For this edition of Insight's Concert Connect, we're going to listen to not one, but two hard-hitting bands from the capital city, two legendary R&B and hip-hop artists, and an internet sensation releasing her debut album. So, without further ado, here are CAP Radio hosts with the most, Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia. Good morning.
Hey.
Hi.
Thanks, Vicky.
So, Andrew, I'm going to start with you, because we just got to go to this weekend, right? Just a couple days from now. You picked Rebecca Black, who's going to be performing this Saturday at Sacramento's Pride Festival. Tell us about her.
Well, folks who are listening might remember the name Rebecca Black from her viral sensation of a hit Friday about 10 years ago, sometime in 2011. And I think a lot of her journey about what's fascinating is her, like, as a person and an artist, is sort of like pivoting away from that moment. I think it was one of those times in the culture that sort of was like, maybe virality isn't all that great. And so, like, taking in a lot of that negative attention at such a young age, I think has been something that she's been moving past emotionally, but also musically, which is why we're here. It's been like a fascinating evolution. And so when I bring up Rebecca Black to people, I think they have like an idea in their head of what she sounds like. And I'm here to tell you that idea is completely wrong. it's pop music, but it's also glitchy. It's moody. In the song we're going to hear, there's some like really heavy breakbeat electronic dance music drums, angsty guitar riffs. Quite good.
Yeah, and even though this is a debut album, this is a musical journey of more than a decade, because that viral internet sensation was like 2011, and we're in 2023 now.
Yeah, been releasing a lot of music. This is her debut studio album, but a lot of EPs and different songs, and even a Friday remix, which was sort of like a tongue-in-cheek culmination of like, I've moved past this. Mm. At least that's how I read it. So I think it's pop music, but in a way, it's a lot of the other sort of things she does is subverting the expectations of pop music. And it's something that feels new, which I think is hard to find in that genre sometimes.
All right. Well, let's listen to Destroy Me.
God, am I just a loser? I bet that's what they always say. Man, everybody's cooler. And the compliments, they seem so fake. I'm so good at getting up. Every time you see me, do you hear violence? Cut a little deeper, there's no reach at the end. Watch me run a crush and burn again and again. Go ahead, destroy me, destroy me. Feeling pretty cute until I ran into you. Chew me up and spit me out like I'm on a shoe. And if you're free and you got nothing better to do, go ahead, destroy me, destroy me. Go ahead, destroy me.
Oh, I like that riff.
Yeah, that's where things start to get like real crazy. And so that's some of what I was talking about. It's like a darker underbelly.
And the debut album is titled Let Her Burn.
Yes, which is a good signifier of what to expect. Great stuff.
Yeah.
The first thing I thought of when I heard that was, this sounds like the Aphex Twin remix of Rebecca Black's like original music from 10 years ago. So.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, just add Aphex Twin and then you get a hit album. Yeah. There you go.
Sure.
All right, Nick, your first pick is someone that I think a lot of people are familiar with. It is Grammy winning artist Erykah Badu, who will be joined by rapper Yasiin Bey, who's formerly known as Mos Def.
Mm,
and
Mighty
that's Mos Def. June 20th, Golden One Center.
We are the sixth stop in the Matriarch of Neo Soul's 25-city tour. And yes, she's bringing along Yasiin Bey. And it also advertised as more extraordinary guests on this particular tour. I love them both, and I think that the pairing of those two is really inspired. There's just such a depth lyrically and musically in both Erykah Badu's work as well as Yasiin Bey's, and the production is deep too. You're not just like, you know, singing or rapping over like some, you know, spat out beat. This is like really well crafted, finely tuned. It's just excellent, excellent artists.
Well, let's take a listen to Window Seat, which is the lead single from her 2010 album. I love that she's still performing, and what a treat that she's going to be in Sacramento.
It's just like a brain massage, isn't it? It is. Her voice and just everything that flows in her music is just so relaxing and deep and wonderful.
When it comes to Yasiin Bey, do they have a history of going, of kind of coupling up and performing together?
I'm not aware of one. No, there could be one, but I couldn't tell you.
So this will might potentially be a first, which is
might be
a nice duo. So your next pick is Sacramento's homegrown garage rock veterans, the Losing Streaks. They're going to be performing, I love this, at the Sacramento Trash Jubilee, which is taking place at several clubs June 22nd to the 24th.
Yes, exactly. It's the first of what I hope are going to be many Sacramento Trash Jubilees. It makes its debut across three nights and three venues. On the 22nd of June, Bottle and Barlow is going to serve as sort of a preview of sorts. DJ Pete Slovenly will be spinning music to kind of paint the vibe of the weekend. And then the Torch Club and Harlow's will be the venues that see the bands perform live. You get like the Nashville Ramblers and the Not Yetis, Low Light, one of my current favorites out of the Sacramento scene right now, the Snares. Good, good stuff abounds. But yes, let's talk about the Losing Streaks, as fronted by Tim Foster and Mike Farrell. They are at the front of this long-running lo-fi rock and roll band. I've been listening to a lot of Link Wray and Southern Culture on the Skids and the Ramones lately, and I find that their sound just snuggles very well within that that miasma.
Well, we're going to listen to Mangalore by the Losing Streaks. All right, so I just very quickly looked up Mangalore. It is a city in India along the Arabian Sea, and I do get some like kind of beach vibes with this.
Yes, I can see what you mean. It sort of falls into that kind of tradition laid down by like the low straight jackets and even go back to like the Shadows, that kind of like just great kind of surfy rock vibe.
What do you want people to know about the Trash Jubilee?
Well, that it looks like a lot of fun and that you'll see me there on Friday the 23rd at the Torch Club. That was when the Losing Streaks will be taking the stage. Doors at 8 o'clock on Friday the 23rd, and then the 24th, more bands at Harlow's.
Awesome. All right, Andrew, so you have circled Destroy Boys. They are a feminist punk band from Sacramento. They're actually going to be the opening act, or one of them, for Blink 182 on Friday, June 23rd at Golden One Center. So what stands out to you about them?
Just so grungy and so full of energy. I've been binging their albums a lot this week, you know, to prepare. And I've realized their music is really good for working out frustrations.
Yes.
You know, like some people meditate, but some people mosh. And if you can't make it to this show, turning your home office into a mosh pit soundtracked by Destroy Boys is a good way to go.
And as we all know, you're one of the angriest people alive.
Yes.
So just listen to you.
Yes. You can't hear it on
every
air.
Every day, Andrew.
To protect the listeners, I have to go into the mosh pit office. And Destroy Boys is great for it. But they're also just so good. In that punky sort of way, their lyrics are funny and witty while also carrying like a lot of sorrow and sort of like a bare-hearted honesty, which is really great when written over these catchy and witty songs. Great guitar riffs all around. Great stuff. And Sacramento's own.
All right. Well, let's listen to Drink from Destroy Boys. Heaven sends someone down. I'm about to turn this confession to a small cloud. Who put me here? It's hard to say. Nails bleed as I crawl out of the grave. I want to play guitar, but I reach for a glass. She says that I'm a star, that I won't last. She understands me like And they also made waves at Coachella this year, right?
Yeah, both them and Blink-182, surprisingly, were at Coachella. So if you want some Coachella vibes, that's the way to go. They're coming up to Sacramento.
Well, as always, thank you, Andrew and Nick.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thanks.
And those are CAP Radio hosts Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia. They are sharing their concert selections for Insight's Concert Connect. As always, you can listen to Hey Listen on CAP Radio. That's Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. and again from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. And our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here Monday.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.